This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti, is a new and fascinating book from Amy Willens, who spent years living in and writing about Haiti. It tells the story of the country's history, its people, and their enormous struggle to rebuild from the massive earthquake that devastated the tiny nation 3 years ago. In her book, Willens writes about Haiti's long history of struggle against foreign intervention. And she says despite its noble intentions, the current international aid effort represents the latest invasion by outsiders.
What depresses me is the invasion of Haiti by this, it's called the Republic of NGOs, which are non-governmental organizations. And effectively, these foreign outside NGOs have replaced the Haitian government.
Amy Willens will be at the Harvard Bookstore next Friday, February 1st. When she joined us recently, I asked her about the book's title, Farewell, Fred Voodoo.
Fred Voodoo is the nickname that foreign journalists gave to the Haitian man in the street years ago in less politically correct times. So they would say to you when you came back to the hotel where you all were staying, they'd say, well, did you talk to Fred Voodoo today? Kind of like Joe Sixpack in America.
Right. Well, I'd love to talk to you about what you've seen there recently, 3 years after this earthquake. You were just in Haiti in December. Where is the country right now in terms of its effort to rebuild?
It's so confusing. It's almost psychotic. In Port-au-Prince, where the earthquake was at its most vicious, and the outlying towns near Port-au-Prince, there are still 358,000 people living in the worst kinds of conditions in refugee camps. So imagine you were in a tent for 3 years, the same tent. It's unthinkable. And these are families, the elderly, babies have been born in these camps. You're in a very insecure situation. There's a lot of robbery and a lot of rape also. But so there's that, an ongoing human rights crisis, I would call it. And yet, up in the north, earthquake reconstruction monies are being spent on an industrial park up there, a new university up there. But the north is not where the earthquake struck. So what you have is a reconstruction of Haiti with earthquake monies, but it's being done in a place with no earthquake victims.
How strange.
So it's very odd. Yeah. But it is the outsiders' plan for Haiti. That's why it is so very, very strange.
Now let's talk about these outsiders and their plan for Haiti, because in discussing foreign aid to Haiti, you refer to something that you call occupation by an army of the innocent. Tell me about this army of the innocent.
Now, look, I don't question their motivation. These are all people who really want to do something good. They really think they can help. And, you know, their motivations and their altruism is unquestionable. But they don't know what they're doing. And that's what I've seen over and over again in Haiti. They don't understand what the consequences of their programs will be. Haiti is the land of unintended consequences. It's very hard to come into a place like Haiti, which has its own culture, its own past, its own history, its own character, and do a valuable program without consulting with Haitians, knowing Haiti, learning about Haiti. It's not a process that you can really do quickly, and that may be a fundamental problem with reconstruction aid.
And so give me an example of how their efforts have gone awry.
Probably the most glaring example is right now those people that I was referring to who are still in camps, the 358,000. So originally, the camps, there were about 1.2 million people in them right after the earthquake. And what outside organizations decided to do was to build some interim housing and get rid of the biggest, most egregious-looking camps that everybody has to see when they come into Port-au-Prince. And the outside organizations offered each Haitian family living in those camps $500, not to move out, but to go toward a new place to live. So either you'd go to interim housing or you'd pay rent for some other housing, but that $500 was to go to your housing. So the Haitians took the opportunity to take those $500 and move out, and they did move out. But so now the people still living in camps, they also would like their $500. You can see, and so they're not going to move out, even though they would like to get out, but they are hoping, assuming that they're going to be moved out and get those $500, which to us may sound like not that much money and certainly not worth living in a four-year-old tent with your family, but to them is the equivalent of more, in many cases, more than a year's earnings.
Hmm. You talk about a compassion economy that benefits mainly those providing the aid, or perhaps a great deal those providing the aid, rather than the Haitians.
So a lot of the fundraising that gets done goes toward payroll for the staff, housing for the staff, and they don't live in shacks alongside Haitians. They live in gated communities with their families often. And they really lead what a writer called Rowan Garrity has called the compound life away from Haitians. Mm. And with the money that they raise, you know, they show victims of the earthquake with amputated limbs living in tents. They raise money, and then a lot of that money goes to pay for their gated community apartment in Port-au-Prince. So it's bound to look fairly bad.
Sure. Now, there are some notable exceptions to this. One of the heroes of the story is Megan Coffey. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yes, she's a doctor who was born and raised in New Jersey, highly diplomated, and she's an expert in infectious diseases, especially tuberculosis. But she went down to Haiti to help out with the earthquake, and then discovered that she was in a country, as I think she knew probably beforehand, with a huge tuberculosis burden. It's one of the biggest killers in Haiti. And so she started treating patients. They put up a tent, and they had an ad hoc tuberculosis ward, which they had not had. And now she has a permanent ward in the hospital simply because of dedication, stick-to-itiveness, and letting Haiti teach her how to deal with Haiti.
Mm. I was relieved to hear, relieved only because he's such a big presence and I could imagine it going in another direction, that the actor Sean Penn, who's really sort of dug in down there, is also making a difference and doing it in a way that makes sense. Is that right?
I think that's right. He made some missteps at the beginning in trying to depopulate his camp. But after that, I think he's tried to rectify it by helping build new housing for the people in the camp that he was supervising. It was a camp of 60,000 people at one time. And because he was Sean Penn, it was the most attractive camp because it had all the best kinds of facilities and clinics and stuff like that. So people kept coming. So he's worked really hard to depopulate that camp, and he's doing a good job at that. He organized a bunch of different groups to take down the National Palace, which was an embarrassment and an eyesore in the middle of Port-au-Prince. You know, it was as if you let the White House sit in ruins for 3 years. He got that done, and rather speedily, too. I think he has good ideas. He has the capacity to organize, and he's both skeptical but not cynical.
You pose the question of what we can do for Haiti in this book, but you also pose the flip side of that question of what Haiti does for us. What's the answer to that?
First of all, they allow this army of the innocent to feel good about itself, mm-hmm. right? You go in there, you feel good. As Sean Penn said, we need Haiti. Haiti makes us understand our humanity, makes us see how lucky we are. Mm-hmm. You can sit in your house watching the earthquake on TV and think, whoa, I'm lucky I don't live there. It looks like it was pretty bad even before this earthquake. And then you can think, good, I get to be me while they're going on having to be them. So, and then there's the possibility for interceding and feeling like you're helping and doing good. And very little feels like a lot of good to an American. You go in, you give $25 to a Haitian, you can't believe how happy they are that they got $25.
I see. As we've mentioned, you've spent all kinds of time there, not just sort of parachuting in as a reporter, but really lived there. And you've fallen in love with the country and its people. And I'm wondering if that presents in any way a struggle as you try to make these connections while still trying to maintain some sort of journalistic distance.
Journalistic distance is something I write about in the book. I'm constantly violating so-called journalistic ethics. You know, like I'll do a really long interview with a Haitian who's living in a tent in a refugee camp, and their kids will be around, and clearly they'll be, you know, malnourished. And at the end of the interview, I might actually dig into my wallet and give them a little bit of money, violating journalistic ethics, because that would be like if you're interviewing, Vice President Cheney, and you gave him $1,000 afterwards. That was, but you know,
I think it's a little different. Yeah.
But I have had actual discussions with my colleagues saying they would never do that. because it would be a violation. And I intercede in stories. Like, there's this little boy who lost both his hands in the earthquake, and he was sitting at Doctors Without Borders early in the morning, and when I came back in the afternoon, he was still sitting waiting to see a doctor. And yes, I interceded in the story, and I picked him up with his mother and brought him to Port-au-Prince for an operation. So I do those things because I think I've lived in Haiti so long I can't stand to just sort of drum my fingers on the table and wait for the story to unfold. And probably that's wrong, but at least it's out there. I don't hide it.
I'm not sure it is wrong, especially the way you describe it, but I am curious, when your journalistic colleagues tell you that it's wrong, how do you answer them?
Well, I can sometimes see their point. Often they say, if you don't intercede, the story is better. Like, yes. There's a famous picture of a kid in the African desert, obviously starving and dehydrated, and there's one tree in the picture, too. It's a black and white photo by James Nachtwey. And people were outraged by this picture because it was like, why don't you pick that kid up and get him to water? And Nachtwey said after he took the picture, he did. But that's the problem, is you want to get the picture, you want to get the story, and if you intercede in these conditions of terrible misery and deprivation, your story is not going to be as good. But I say, I don't care that much about the story.
Well, despite the huge challenges that Haiti is facing now and will probably be facing for a long time to come, you express an awful lot of hope about the future of Haiti in your book. What makes you so hopeful?
First of all, if you have to choose between hope and nihilism, I'm going to choose hope, because the other is just not satisfying politically or psychologically. I hope because of Haiti's fabulous history. I also have hope because I know Haitian people, incredible human capacity is being wasted in that country. It is one of the great tragedies of Haiti is how the state and the government have failed to function on behalf of the Haitian people. And when it was experimented with a government that ostensibly wanted to help the Haitian people, the Aristide government, he was ousted before he had even completed 1 year in office. Then he was reinstated by President Clinton, and then he was ousted again by George Bush, number two. So, you know, when Haiti has tried, the outsiders have seemed not to be willing. I find that very concerning, because I think there's a lot of hope that you can muster for Haitians on the ground, but not if they're going to be continually repressed by outsiders.
Well, Amy Willens, it's such a great read. I'm grateful for coming in and talking about it and for this great book. Thanks for talking to us about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Amy Willens. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She'll be at the Harvard Bookstore next Friday, February 1st.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from theangle@boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.